I also wanted to say that I no longer am doing the Resurrect Extinct Vibration Project as I have been doing in parks where it's safe. I now only do it where there's a lot of human traffic. And so now I'm always keeping in check with friends, whatever city I'm in, for when I do get arrested, because I've been getting closer and closer to that. Of course, I would go into a visitor center, like I was just in Minnesota, and you cross the state line in your car, and then there's this giant bizarre welcome center with leaflets about where to go spend your money and all that, and hotels to spend your money. It's all about spending money, right? And so I would just put my blanket in the visitor center on the floor, not in anybody's way, just, and start to do the project, and people will make me leave and threaten to call the police. I started to do it in Walmarts, and I wasn't being rude. I didn't do it where everybody's walking. I put the blanket near a shampoo and greeting cards where there are not a lot of people. But I was actually picked up by two men and thrown out the door with my blanket. So I'm getting closer and closer to needing a lawyer, probably, with this. Part of the project involved me panhandling in front of the airport for a ticket to Alaska, and the idea was to get to the real remaining wilderness. And I had a sign that said I need a ticket to Alaska, and I had a little smiley face to encourage this. And the Homeland Security eventually, so I kept coming back after they threw me out, and I was finally taken to a room and with these very aggressive German shepherds. They were sniffing my bags, and then this man came in a suit and read me some document about what will happen to me if I do this again, because it's against the law in the United States to be panhandling in front of an international airport after 9/11. So I decided to, and actually what he said to me was, and when you go to jail, you're not going to regular jail. So I thought, well, I don't know, regular jail's bad enough. This project that you see here, I call Mount Monadnock Transmission. I had a boyfriend, this is him, his name is Earth. He changed his name to Earth, he was born Mark Holmes. He was an amazing human being. He was an AIDS activist and an environmental activist. In 1998, he was down in Tennessee, the state of Tennessee, working in an all-queer spiritual community. And I was on the phone with him. We were making plans for me to come down and visit. He told me about a cave that he had found to meditate in every morning. And soon after that phone call, men followed him to the cave, and they hogtied him. They bound his wrists and his feet together, and they beat him and tortured him and raped him, and then covered him in gasoline and burned him to death. And they needed his dental records to prove that it was him, because they couldn't recognize him anymore. His tattoos were burned off as well. That was one of the most devastating things that I have ever been told. I then went about the business of trying to make the police do something about this. The police were not interested in doing anything about it. Not only were they not interested in doing about it, they were threatening me. The sheriff called me faggot with a capital F, like it was my name. He would refer to me as faggot. He would, and with his thick southern accent, he would say, you know, you listen here, faggot. You just stay in Philadelphia and mind your own business. He told me that if I went back down again, he was going to arrest me and have me committed. So I did the best I could. I didn't know what to do. I mean, when you have the police. By the way, that sheriff is now in prison for raping women in the jail under his care. The new sheriff is a much more sensitive person, but he still believes the story that my boyfriend was committed suicide. It's impossible to kill yourself with your hands and legs bound. And also, there were no empty gasoline containers. A four-year-old could tell you this was a homicide. The coroner and the paramedics have always been on my side that this is a homicide. The level of homophobia in the United States right now is just staggering. In the past 9 months, more than 200 anti-lesbian, gay, transgender laws have been issued by lawmakers. They are what I refer to as Christian extremists. and they are ruling the United States. And I live in the state of North Carolina now, and there is a new law that says that you are forbidden to use the bathroom unless you're using the one assigned to you at birth on your birth certificate. So transgender people are being arrested left and right now. In the state of Tennessee, they just passed a law that doctors, even in the emergency room, no longer have to help gay and lesbian transgender people. They can throw you out on the street to die. In the states of Arizona and Indiana, they just passed laws stating that individuals working in businesses and business owners can throw gay and lesbian people out of the store. They don't have to wait on you. In the state of Mississippi, they just passed a law that gay and lesbian transgender people are no longer allowed to adopt children. It's just snowballing. This fascist homophobia is just sweeping the nation right now. So I did a ritual. I did three rituals. I'm not going to read the ritual. I'm just going to briefly tell you about it. I did three rituals to overcome my depression after my boyfriend's murder. It was such a dark time. For several months after his murder, I was so depressed that I couldn't believe that this was what it was. That this is what depression, I mean, I'd been depressed before, but this was something that I just couldn't imagine ever getting out of. I was convinced that this was my life from now on. And so, the first ritual I did was, well, I'm not gonna talk about the first two, I will say this. I did three rituals because the first two didn't work. They worked in the sense that I got poems out of them that I was happy with, but I didn't feel any better. But I'm a Capricorn. We're the most determined of the signs. We're the goat climbing the mountain. My mother named me Craig, which is Scottish for brave climber, because she knew I was going to be a Capricorn, a goat climbing the mountain. I feel like that's really served me. I hung in there, and I was convinced that I could make this work. So what I did was, I found, so there's a crystal that he gave me the last time I saw him when he was alive. It was a crystal that he had on him the entire time for a year and a half before he handed it to me. After he was murdered, I put the crystal away. I didn't want to see it. Whenever I would accidentally see the crystal, it would ruin my day. I decided that I needed a new ingredient to my ritual, something that was going to really push me as far as I could to really be serious about what I wanted. My goal was to end my depression. So I had a fellowship and a residency from the McDowell Arts Colony in New Hampshire. I went. I took this crystal with me. I also took a smaller, round, clear quartz crystal. In scientific research for crystals, piezoelectricity, as well as other quartz crystal technologies, we can see that the current in crystals is one of the most consistent things on this planet. I was trying to push that technology a little bit further. I was using his crystal as a library of his day, his breathing, everything that he went through for a year and a half, when we would visit, when we would be together. And then I would swallow the smaller crystal. That was what I could refer to as the worker crystal. So I would swallow the smaller crystal. I would put his crystal under my hair wrap against my third eye. And then I would swallow the smaller crystal. The smaller crystal was pulling all of the transmissions out of his crystal, all of that information stored in there about his days and his life and his breath and his heartbeat, and pulling them into my blood, my tissue, my bones, and it worked. It worked so fast, I was shocked, and I was so shocked it took me a little while to realize that this was good, this was okay. I was so used to the depression at this point. I was so used to trying to not kill myself that I was shocked that this was actually working. And so every day I would do this, you know, I would do this every day, and I would shit the other crystal out and then sterilize it and eat it again, and I became very excited about this. So this resulted in 27 poems. When I say it worked, here's why it worked. I had a movie playing in my head. This tormented me because the police weren't doing their job. They were never going to catch these killers. They weren't interested. I couldn't get anybody to do anything about it. The police had even turned some of my friends against me, who would call me a child for not accepting the truth of a suicide. That movie in my head that I had created was of this courtroom drama and my anger at the killers and anger at the police, and it all just vanished like that. It happened just so quickly, and it's never returned. I also would put his crystal under my pillow at night and sleep with them under my pillow, and those dreams were very helpful. I want to read this. There's a poet named Akilah Oliver. And I want to read, this is from the ritual, just this last paragraph. The last time I saw poet Akilah Oliver before she died, we were sitting at a bar after a poetry reading, and I told her of the ritual I was about to do to overcome my depression of Earth's murder. Not this ritual you are reading, but the first one where I liked the resulting poem but felt no better. She was encouraging, and we spoke of death as a shared space with all life, and this conversation led us down a dark thread about our planet's pillaged ecosystems. And in a panic, I said, there is no way to fix our dying planet. She touched my shoulder and said, CA, you are about to do a ritual to heal yourself, and you are part of the planet. So you are healing part of the planet by healing yourself. If you were fortunate enough to know her, you would know that that's exactly the type of human being she was. Amazing. It made us both smile and toast to healing the planet by healing ourselves. And today I hold a glass to let Akilah know that it worked finally. It worked, Akilah. Poetry did this to me and I am free. I'm going to share some of the poems with you now. A spider's web is made of digested fly brains, wings, hairs, legs, tears, pheromones, attracting more flies, dissolving us into the endeavor of love. Hold me to your song, it is delicious. Hear you one more time in middle of night, tooth it open. Love all unloved parts without pause. Dear ghost, flickering with flames that no longer hurt. Deflated lungs expanding, you say, they can only burn a faggot once. When you died the way you died, it was contaminating. A new danger of being lost and insecure. But reality can never be avoided forever. At the same moment, who is afraid of whom? The killers or my beloved? Or guilt of my continued song? Desire is not what we achieve. It's a knife often carving the wrong way, or racking it in the alchemy of a mood. I should never trade youth for poetry's resonance of aging. But I can put every poem I ever wrote in a pile and burn them if you would appear on the other side. Your rapists were the last to taste you in this world. Their breath and terror down your neck keeps me up at night. But which page of the Bible says to burn the faggot after you force him to give you your pleasure? Each time I drink water drop from clouds, water they burned out of your body, I cup my hands to catch you. In the revenge dream, I behead one of them, spell your name on my face with his blood. The other is begging as I choke him. His neck as soft as your neck. I pull him off his knees, check for tattoos. Is it him? Is it you? I miss you. I love you. My need to attack your killers. This is where I failed you. I should give them a trophy. A faggot-killing trophy. They won. Jesus-loving faggot killers always win. How strong was my failure to keep you alive? I am sorry coming out the golden head of dandelion, smashing through cement. Universe expanding at cruel speed. Sorry hogs, room in the stomach. A horizon we let into our eyes. Can only finish this poem with those eyes. Smash through cement, lonely and sick with glory of the bloom. The spirit of your flowers is my favorite shelter. We were in love is the main thing. Faintest green light and tree pulls me forward. Whenever life is beautiful makes me think of you. Carry color of the forest to be with you. To belong to this world with you. To have what we have and that is it. Yes, the present is between the past and future. But it's too radical to be called the middle. Poetry, or another shovel, working where the real America buried you. The kind of men shown a table with blueprints of our city to destroy us. When they punish us, it is exactly how we knew it would feel. Places with the least warmth, exchanged with places we miss one another in. Sunlight snorkel of corn silk as the hummingbird drinks your wounds away. Fuck the real America up the ass with the fake one. Let it all be done, you said. Let it all be done, I said. Another poet apologizes at a microphone, weakening the hull of our ship. If you can't believe in your poems, leave them at home until you learn to deserve them. This poem, this poet will not apologize. I'm tired of smelling my dead boyfriend, his swimming arms lost to my bed. It hurts to admit I love being alive. I broke, and those pieces broke, and those pieces crushed to powder. Things to avoid saying around me, take it like a trooper, stiff upper lip, keep it together. Don't let your mouth say these things. Don't let your comfort be selfish cruelty. Let them shriek, let them sob. Don't be a coward about love. Every single human ambition cultivated by fear of death. It is not failure but age you smell. I am often disgusted with life here without you. Despondence growing sinister. The kind of fear when you don't care if you scrape the car while leaving the parking lot, getting the fuck out before the police arrive. Today, we give love that same abandonment. Dear Earth, it is okay to not roll the stone back uphill. We rent memory storage in the world you left behind. Little wonder in this dull of broken trees. Daisies bend under our slightest breath. You did not answer after you died. It is when I learned to be lonely everywhere. Between dreaming and crying until it calcified and fell off. So the next thing I want to talk about is the work that's beautifully translated in this chapbook. I'm very grateful for that. Thank you for that as well. It's very exciting to have that. I received a Lannan Fellowship. My mother thinks that I'm robbing banks. She doesn't think this is real. She can't believe that somebody's going to fly me into Western Texas, to the mecca of the art world, Marfa, Texas, where Donald Judd's work is and all this artwork, and just leave me there to write my poems. And I said to her, I remember on the phone, she's like, are you running drugs? That's really, I looked at a map and that's pretty close to the border there in Mexico. Are you fucking around with me? And I said, no, I'm not. I got a fellowship and they're giving me a Prius to drive and money to eat with, and I wanted to create a ritual. I wanted to do a ritual in a way that I've never done. I wanted to do this ritual so badly, and I did it, and I'm so excited that I did it. I would do it all over again. It was exhausting. The labor of this was so intense, but I loved every second of it. What I did was I took 36 days, and I did 36 rituals every single day for 36 days. By the third day, I thought that this was just ridiculous. By the third day, I thought this was just not going to, I wasn't going to be able to continue doing this, to continue doing 30, but it was exciting. One of the things I would do every morning would to be watch the, so this is a real sunset in Western, a sunrise in Western Texas, but the first thing I would do would to, I would wake up before the sun rose, and I would look at the Edgar Cayce web, there's a webcam on their meditation room overlooking the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean. And of course, I'm in the middle of the nation, so that sunrise is about 2 hours before the sun rose where I was. So I went at two sunrises every morning, because that's beautiful. And then I would go out and watch this every day, and the sunrises there were just like this every single morning. I love Marfa, Texas so much. Once you're there, it gets in your blood in this way. Their biggest freaks in America move down there, and I love these people. And if I find out I have a week left to live, I'm gonna drive through every red light to get there, just spend my last week there. One of the other rituals, just to take this movie Giant, it's a despicable movie, I don't recommend it. It's James Dean's last film, but whatever, it's super racist and horrible. And it's just abominable, this movie. But Elizabeth Taylor, Rock Hudson, whatever. And what I did was I divided the film into 36 sections, which came to 5 minutes and 22 seconds a day, I believe, something like that. So watching this movie, there's nothing worse. I think the only thing worse than watching the movie all the way through in one sitting is to watch it in little bits every day for 36 days. And you just start seeing people, you just start thinking you're seeing people on the street. Because the reason I'm watching this movie was shot in Marfa, Texas. So, but whatever, if I had to redo this ritual, I would cut that part out. So the other thing I wanted to do was I would go to the supermarket every morning, every early afternoon. It's called Pueblo Market. It's this wonderful supermarket, but like it's very strange. Just a lot of weird, giant dead animals hanging on hooks in the room and stuff. But and I've been a vegetarian for many years, so it's kind of weird seeing. I grew up hunting, so it's just odd. It's just odd seeing all these strange things from my childhood, like deer hanging from a hook by their neck. But I would go out to the parking lot with a magnifying glass, and I would look for a color. And then I would get down on my knees. This photo was chewing gum that was on the macadam, the parking lot. And I would study the color very carefully. And then I would go directly into the grocery store and look at all the labels on all the aisles of all the strange items until I found a matching color. And of course, in this case, it's the Lucky Charms marshmallow moon. I was looking for the intersections of temperature, and you could just find them you can always find them in grocery stores because there's so much color involved, especially colors like blue, because it's marketing teams, they're the ones who discovered that the color blue hits the human optic nerve first. So another thing I did was I had a sweet potato. One of my favorite toys as a child was my Mr. Potato Head. And I love Mr. Potato Head more than the children I grew up with. There's a documentary that just came out about my life and my writing, and it also deals with the murder of my boyfriend who went down to Tennessee. But the filmmakers, they're lovely people, but they're from New Zealand, and they think they understand America, but then when they get there, it's really much more horrifying than they could imagine. Where I grew up in Pennsylvania, it is the headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan. Their children are now, there are a lot of neo-Nazis now because they want to prove to their parents that they're cooler. and their fascist tastes. It's real. This is not a joke. It's fucking crazy there. It's upsetting. And then when I was just there recently, they don't just have Trump signs, they have posters of Donald Trump. And they are like praying that he wins. Anyway, Mr. Potato Head was preferable to these evil Nazi kids I was going to school with. But why might I use sweet potato? I like sweet potatoes, so they said it was organic. I don't know. And I gave her a little head piece. It's sort of like this, but it's shinier. And I would love to be able to have... So when I reincarnate again, I'm going to reincarnate on a planet where I can take something like that and put it on my head, and it's just as big proportionally, so that when I move, it's just like sweet potato baby doll. The thing is, I would carry sweet potato baby doll around Marfa, and people kind of started getting used to this. And, you know, like the barber would say, "You're that poet coming down here." And I would say, "Yes, sir, I am. You have that sweet potato?" And I would be like, "Yes, sir, I do." And I would take her out of the bag, and I would show him sweet potato baby doll, and then I would move on. So there are 36 rituals altogether. That's just a few of them. Mars point one. To be gone, a constant desire. Embarrassed for the giant leaning in for love. We had enough of the dance number, but the whirling begins, it just starts. Silos full of air, no more corn, no more wheat. Watching myself for full details in a strange man's pants. We let the soldier board the plane, shot in head 3 days later. "Why are you angry?" you said. "Why are you not?" I said. Mars point two. To worship tininess of a martyr. Observe shrinking church in rearview mirror. The black deer, it turns out, was beige, a tando covered in flies. Flesh of shame is nearly the shame of flesh. Pressing an unstable clock to cactus with one, two, three counts of recalibration. Fuck you who asked for forgiveness instead of permission. All clocks are precarious, inscrutable windows. Saturn point one. Butterfly in a tissue box, not a real one, a painting, a monarch. One more sign for anguish poured and poured, a choice to feel or stack bricks between. I was sad when my talented friend started designing television commercials. He told me to grow up. But the rocks in the desert I touched signal an endless new place. Something without money saying, never tire of demanding love for the world. Uranus point four. The only goal in my last life was to come back a poet. We had to leave, which meant backwards in the dance. Check vital signs in the meadow, or maybe it was a rooftop. I don't know how I convinced them to let me do it. I used to think it was because I pleased them. Nothing mattered after climbing stairs to see you for the first time in centuries. Oh, okay, so I'm gonna tell you about this. So while I was down there, this Matt, I'm not here to gossip, so I've been the subject of gossip my whole life, and I don't really approve. So anyway, this magazine, pretty well known, editor writes to me while I'm down there and he says, "I really admire your poems. Could you send me some poems for the next issue?" I said, "Well, thank you, here's some poems." And then he writes back later in the afternoon, "These are very depressing. Maybe you could send some happier poems." And I just wrote back, "Fuck you." That was it. Didn't deserve poetry if you can ask for that. Pluto point two. They requested a happier poem, the distinct sound of a backstab. Up in the stomach getting a fix on the signal. Leave vomit on the seat and tell them we are not sorry for any of it. Poke surrounding haystack in search of a slow song. Excess is haunted by our poverty of benevolence, but we grab a broader patch of shoulder, corrupt the smallest eyes and the freshly printed poem. One of the rituals that I did was to go to this bar each day. It's an amazing bar. It's a cowboy bar called the Lost Horse Saloon. And there's this amazing young man who runs, he's the manager of the, hi, I like your bicycle, I've been admiring it. I like your bird bicycle. You can want to hear me. That's good. I approve of that. So I sang, oh, so his name is Tim Johnson, and he's the manager of the Marfa Book Company, which is this great bookshop with an incredible poetry section. Anyway, he and I were sitting in this bar. One of the rituals was to go into this bar. I didn't want to go where all the artists were. I'm nothing against artists, but I was there to write, and I wanted to see the people who actually live in the city, because these towns are not made up by the artists who visit, they're made up by the people who live there. So I really wanted to be around Marfa. So we go to this bar where all the cowboys were, and Tim and I were having whiskey shots, and this horse, this is just one evening, this giant white horse comes right into the bar with this woman on it with a long blonde braid. She's a cow herder. She's this kind of marvelous person out there. And she would leap off the bar. All the cowboys were like, woo-hoo, you know, and the dogs, their dogs were crazy, going crazy. There's dogs in the bar. So they'd be like barking. And the horse would be stamping its foot and snorting. She would get a drink and then get back on the horse and leave. The whole thing was like 5 minutes. Pluto point four. We win from time to time, abandoned above adaptable positions of the losing. We risk everything in thinking we can navigate Maverick of the Green, carry a bottle of wine into the pumpkin patch, looking for a new way to angle the old songs. Sell me a ticket to your dance, please. I believe in the strength of poetry. A little stone in the moth helps balance her on my breath. So, I don't know if you're familiar with this picture is, but if you've ever heard of the Marfa Lights? The Marfa Lights are these wonderful, it's a wonderful experience. If you ever get down to Marfa, you have to see these. Every evening, at dusk, if you go along the highway, there's a station, it's adobe, and there are binoculars and you can watch. You don't actually even need binoculars, but they are nice to have. And these balls of light will rise out of the desert floor. This has been happening for many centuries. The Native American tribe known as the Apache considered these lights to be the campfires of their ancestors from other, you know, times past. In 1888, this is what's so annoying and racist about the story to me. They say the first person who saw them, which of course they've already said, well, yeah, the Apache had been seeing them for centuries, right? The first person to see them was this white cowboy who thought they were Apache campfires, and then he would ride out there and find out that they're these balls of light, and they rise out. They're a form of plasma. A lot of people who are witness to volcanoes erupting. Prior to the volcano erupting, these balls of light will come rolling down the side of the volcano. This is very similar. And they'll rise out of the ground, and then sometimes they'll change colors. Sometimes they will chase your car down the highway. I've met people who have that happen. Just beautiful. I love the Marfa lights. This is my book called The Book of Frank. This is a book that I wrote over an 18-year period. I was saying 16 until I really looked at it and I realized it was 18, but it's a long time. And there were 1,584 poems altogether. And the book, which is here, has 130 poems in it. And the book's been translated into 6 different languages now. I'm very excited about this book, coming from people who are mostly illiterate and don't have bookshelves. It's kind of, I just feel humbled and amazed that I have a book translated and that I get to come here and speak with you. And it's being translated into Danish currently by Lena Kalmeier. She's just brilliant. I love her. If you ever get to read Lena, she has a book called 9 Days with the Exorcist. She got permission from the Vatican to spend 9 days with the head exorcist in the Vatican. It's a very upsetting book. It's very strange. And But what I did was, so I, the book, this book really started off, I don't want to talk about the whole crisis around it, but I wrote this book, and I had a little chapbook back in the early 90s. I was reading from that tiny little chapbook from the first poems at the Near Rican Poets Cafe in the lower Manhattan, New York City. And Bob Kaufman was in the audience, Bob Holman. And he asked me if I wanted to go on tour, and I said, sure. And I had no idea that it was the Lollapalooza tour. So I was on the 1994 Lollapalooza tour with all this drama that I don't want to get into. I don't think poets should be around rock stars. It's just grotesque, the way they act. And like, I tried to put together, I don't want to talk about them. So they're just, who cares about them? But they were always hanging around the poetry tent because they won poetry credit, and they were just kind of despicable. But anyway, the thing is, I had all these poems, so Jonathan Williams, who is one of the last living Black Mountain College poets, student of Charles Olson's, brilliant man, his press, he wrote to me, one of these chapbooks made its way to his home, and he wrote to me, he said, you have more of these? And I said, yeah, I can't stop writing them. And he said, I want to publish a book, and I just couldn't believe it. I thought somebody was pulling a prank on me, because this is somebody who's published some of my most favorite poets, Mina Loy, Robert Creeley, you know, just this long list of people, Kenneth Patchen. Eventually, Jonathan, while we were working the book, he passed away. So then Wave Books picked it up. But so the book contains 130 poems, but there were 1,584 poems altogether. And people were constantly asking for me to get those poems out and expand the book or do a sequel. And I don't like that idea. I didn't want them. And I thought, well, you know, the way my life is right now, I mean, who knows? It's very easy to die on the road the way I'm living right now. So, and I've had some pretty, very awful close calls with being surrounded, my car being surrounded in a Walmart parking lot by men with baseball bats. That's a whole other story. So what I did was I said, I'm gonna take control of this situation. So I just did this, just a couple weeks ago. This is brand new. What I did was I took that box of poems, and these are poems that were never on a computer file. They're poems that were all typed on a typewriter in a box. And so I took them and I burned them all. And I burned them with a rose quartz in the middle. And then I was humbling to see this small pile of ash after 18 years of work, you know. That's it, forget it, you know, it's over. And I swallowed the rose quartz, and then I took the ashes and put them in a bathtub with warm water and jasmine tea. Jasmine is what the poet Sappho used to use to call the muses. So I did this jasmine bath with the ashes, and then I would drink this water and with the rose quartz, and then I wrote this poem. This is the resulting poem. So all of these things that I've read so far are gonna be in my book that's gonna come out next year around this time. It's coming out from Wave Books. It's called While Standing in Line for Death. Because I thought I would have a really cheerful title this time. There is no prison named love. Your dogs have my scent. I will never allow you to stain my eyes with your angels and martyrs. I no longer lie still, let you sob into my open mouth. I'm not here for conversion, old man. I'm here to bury you with your dogs. All it takes is an airplane in my head and you are gone, you get it? How you must suffer pretending to be kind. Like the days when codependence was what everyone dreamed they wanted. I fixed the broken leg of poetry, the only influence that never tried to restrain me. For my help, poetry put a little light under my rib. Moths follow as we stroll into the night. I thought I would end by reading from the book of Frank. I'm going to go to this microphone over here. Oh, and if anybody is... If anybody is interested... Hello? Is this working?
Yes.
Okay. If anybody is interested, I have these little samples of Frank poems if you want free. Hello. Okay. When Frank was born, father inspected this small package the nurse handed him. But where's my daughter's cunt? My daughter has no cunt. Mother leaned from the bed. This is your awful son, dear. Your son has no cunt. Why doesn't my son have a cunt? What has happened? What a wicked world, dark and spinning on its one good leg. Frank hated the 9 miscarriages. Okay, so before I read this, I read the, did we close the doors because I went on too long? Is that what we're like, or no, we're just closing the doors?
Because of the volume.
What's that?
The volume, because of the neighbors.
Oh, I'm too loud. All right. That's good. So I was reading the memoir of President George W. Bush, and I don't know if you've read it. It's actually a very interesting reading. And in the mornings, not every morning, but some of the mornings, his mother, Barbara Bush, you know her, she wore a lot of blue, said some really evil racist things after Katrina. She would show him a jar with a miscarried fetus in it and formaldehyde at breakfast. The man who invaded countries and killed millions of people. Frank hated the 9 miscarriages kept in jars of formaldehyde. Mother burped each one, spooned peas against the glass. She rocked them all at once in her arms, no room for Frank. You are too big for a jar, my child. You'll betray me the rest of your life. Good. At the dinner party, Frank lost his fruit cup. He looked under the table, saw how people touch themselves, even at dinner parties, zipper stroked, knees reacquainted with palms. His eyes clouded in jubilation. But where is Frank, they asked, while on their laps, the only answer was a tiny, mysterious violet. Father was drunk and yelling, and rule number 9, everybody dies. Upon hearing rule number 9, Frank suddenly forgot all other rules. Frank grew crows for hands. It was a difficult childhood. At dinner during prayer, his crows flapped excited in the name of the Lord. Frank! Keep still, mother hollered. Did you wash your crows? Did you wash your filthy, stinking crows? When father died, Frank was found straddling him, his crows picking the 7 gold fillings. So, as a teenager, when I ran away to Philadelphia, I was shocked to find out that gay men, I just assumed that the gay and lesbian community was uniformly going to be against racism and misogyny, and I was rudely awakened. And as a young gay man, I couldn't believe that when I was alone with other gay men, the shit that could be said about women. And I was constantly having these fights and saying, we wouldn't be here without the women. If it weren't for the women's movement and all the women, and it weren't for all the lesbians doing all the work, you know, there wouldn't have ever been a gay and lesbian movement, so fuck you. So I wrote this for them because they're afraid of, you know, a big giant vagina is going to swallow them. This is for them. Frank saw a giant eat a park bench with her vagina, drink a swimming pool with her vagina. I saw her swallow the baby and spit out the crib, Frank said. He tiptoed past her snoring uterus one night and heard a few familiar voices cry out. Would you sign my book, Mr. Poe? Frank asked the pile of bones amid shovels of dirt. Why, certainly, young man, answers Frank in a different voice. This is your captain, Frank says from the cockpit. All passengers wishing to bail out any time during our flight, it is too late. I have shredded the parachutes to confetti in celebration of our arrival. This still hasn't happened yet, but I'm gonna tell you, it's gonna happen. So my friend Nail, that's her name, she has this poem tattooed on her shoulder. So the next time I see her, which I hope is gonna be this fall, I'm gonna take a Polaroid of her tattoo, and then my tattoo is gonna be the Polaroid. Frank knows a butterfly who wonders about her old caterpillar friends. Frank woke once, 4 feet shorter. A boy or severed man. Anyone who can't see he's a boy at heart is blind to hearts. For love, Frank spoke softly into envelopes instead of writing letters. At the party, everyone traced fingers on their bodies where they preferred to have cancer if they had to have cancer. The host asked Frank where he'd like to have his. What a question, Frank said. I'd like my cancer right here, and traced a circle on the host instead. I'm here for the show, the man said, looking under Frank's shirt for the door. I know theater, Frank said. A line formed. Must he admit them all? Many had umbrellas. A blind woman waited with her dog. It's going to be a great show, someone said. But when's he going to let us in? Frank's tears began to fall. Someone ripped his doors open. They filled him for an hour. From the menu of dead authors, Frank orders Emily Dickinson's breasts with dumplings and the braised five anise nin. His wife orders Leo Tolstoy's ring finger with caviar and the candied genitals of Jack Kerouac. Kerouac's erection arrives, shimmering in gravy. She says, nibbling the tip. Frank glares and stabs a breast. At the doctor's request, Frank stopped shaving the chair. In a month, it was the most comfortable chair in the house. Frank hands the cowboy a wad of tissues. These contain semen I produced when thinking of you. The cowboy sniffs them and smiles. Thanks, Frank. I'll put them with the others. Sounded like a Brooklyn cowboy, I guess. Is no one else sick of this paralysis of gravity? Frank asks. When I was a boy, I stepped into the sky, and I was a boy, not a surrealist. Part of the dream is that you accept your waking life as part of the dream. Pig says to Frank, this fence keeps you in your world. Frank says to Pig, this fence keeps you in your world. Pig says to Frank, this fence keeps you in your world. Frank says to Pig, this fence keeps you in your world. Pig says to Frank, this fence keeps you in your world.
I'm really happy that you also talked about the rituals and showed us some of them and some of the biographical information that went into them in your life, and also gave us a glimpse of the Book of Frank. Gave us, I feel, a very rich picture. And I was just hoping, I think some of us who did the workshop would know about your use of the word somatics. And I think we could maybe talk about that as well. But one thing that I was actually interested in is there's a moment in the Book of Frank, because I talked to somebody at some point and it was like, they just kind of thought that they were so different, you know, that they were so, so different. And I think the first time I read them, I probably felt like, oh, this is a big jump, you know. But once I became more familiar with the somatics and your idea behind them and your sense of humor and, well, just the whole, everything that goes into it, I then was rereading it recently and I found a quote in the Book of Frank where, on page 70, where it says, "No, it's too sinister how one experience is quietly consumed by the next." And I was thinking, that's it, that's already in there, the seed of this hyper-presence. And I thought maybe you could just tell us about the state of hyper-presence and how you get there with the rituals and how to sustain it.
Can you hear me? Is it working? Okay. So, how to get there? Thank you for asking that. Let's see. So, the thing is about these rituals is to do these or unorthodox things with your life, right? To do very peculiar little things with your life so that you break out of the routines. You just, and it only takes like the slightest little nudge, actually. You don't need something incredibly dramatic to do it, but it's astonishing how the language that comes out of you shifts. And it becomes addictive because you start to really love your life in a new way. And you start to see everything. My favorite example, I think I mentioned this in the workshop, maybe I didn't, but when I was in Texas doing the Marfa portrait machine, I was at the post office, and this car slowly rolled up and was playing this song from my childhood called Band of Gold. It's this pop song, this old song I really loved as a kid, but I hadn't heard it in decades. So I stood there and I was listening to it, and I was thinking, oh, what are those? What's that instrument? Are those really the lyrics? And then I went about my business, and I realized later on that evening that that was pretty important, because if I had heard that song a decade ago, I would have been dragged into nostalgia, because that's what, you know, like, oh, my old songs from my childhood, and you get all like weepy or whatever happens. But I'm not. I didn't do that. I was very present. It was like hearing that song for the first time. This is what I mean about how this is infiltrated by life. I could give a lot of examples. That's my favorite example, to have this song come back, and I didn't even get it right away.
Yeah. So it's a way not only to create a space in which you write that is hyper-present, but a way of life as well. It extends beyond that.
Plus I do them every day. There are some of them take an afternoon to do. Like I've been doing, I just recently did a lot of them. Like I did one, do you mind me talking about this a little bit?
Like
the length of them, because, so I did one with the law about transgender bathroom issues where I'm living. I did one with Bubbles. I call them queer bubbles, and have the children and out in public, like, you know, coming after the bubbles I was blowing, and then I would tell their parents, like, these are queer bubbles, they're going to make your children queer, and they're going to be revolutionaries, and they're going to rid the world of racism. Because the thing is, queer, like, I'm really tired of this idea that queer is the umbrella term for gay and lesbian. No. I was part of Queer Nation back in the 80s and 90s and ACT UP. Queer is the opposite of the umbrella. It's closing the umbrella. Queer is a result of being tired of the racism and misogyny in the gay and lesbian community. Queer meant that you were serious politically, and that's what I would like to reclaim. It's kind of just lost now. But anyway, yeah, I would say that to the parents, who most of them would freak out and take their kids screaming away from the bubbles. Another one that I did was, I grew up, most of my family are born-again Christians, so I've had the Book of Romans crammed down my throat over and over again, you know, the Apostle Paul. I've never even met Jesus. And, you know, that's the book of the Bible that says that homosexuals should be exterminated, right? Those are the quotes they use before they kill us. You know, the poet Judy Braun has this great quote about, in her book Another Mother Tongue, which is basically charting European before Europe was colonized by the church and pagan cultures and where gay people landed in that, how important we were to the different tribes throughout Europe, and we were an essential part of everything. And then the burning. Anyway, what I did was I took up the Book of Romans, and it's 9 pages, and I pulverized each page after reading it, and then I would put it in a suppository and then stick it up my ass, and then go into town with a bell, and I would ring the bell and yell the names of the dead. I would name, you know, my boyfriend had died of AIDS, my boyfriend was murdered, all the victims of the shooting in Orlando, and I just go on and on with, you know, like there's such an epidemic in the United States of African American trans women. I think they have the highest rate of murder at this point. And yeah, it's devastating. In Philadelphia, where I lived for many years, we would have, like the last few years or so, we used to have these drag shows in honor of these people, these wonderful people that many of us knew, but then the numbers of their murders were so high that we started doing mass memorials at the end of the year in December. But anyway, yeah, that was very exciting, putting the Bible up my ass. It felt good. Anyway, there are ones that I do that are very long, like I've been doing one every day since 2010 with my hair. The United States is bombing 7 nations right now. Somalia, and so what I do is I look at the latest body counts every morning, and then I measure the war dead by inches of hair, and then I write. And I feel like obligated to keep going, and it's just getting worse, you know? Just now we're in Libya, we're in 6, and now we're in 7. So the length is always different.
I don't know if you have questions, we can get there in a sec, but one thing that I wanted to address first was what I think is really exciting is if you go from the first book of Somatics, A Beautiful Marsupial Afternoon, the first book that Wave put out at least, then to Ecodeviance, to the new ones that we were showing on the screen, and don't mind my sloppiness of the book, but the Martha ones is the sense of space that's going on in the poems, and it's probably very difficult to see, but I think a lot of them in the first book are a lot more aligned and slowly, or maybe just in chunks, you know, like they're slowly moving to then. There's these, like, often, and it's a good example I opened up to you, probably won't be able to see it, but also so quite aligned, but always these, like, visual interventions in it that are happening a lot, to the new poems, which we saw, which are this beautifully sculpted image, you know, as well. And I'm just also interested to know about how you think of them in terms of their visual aspect, as well as their sonic aspect, and how that's developed over time for you.
I believe very firmly that we really are just, we're mediums for the spirit world. This is something that poets like Jack Spicer talked about, HD in her own way, talked about. The Christian mystic Edgar Cayce, who would do channels to heal people. If you're familiar with the Edgar Cayce Institute, Virginia Beach, he cured 50,000 people, these documents, and then they would talk about, these voices that would come through and would talk about ancient Atlantis and Lemuria. But they would also occasionally talk, because the librarians over the past century have painstakingly indexed the entire 50,000 channeled documents. So if you go to the Caracalla, you can look up poetries, which is exactly what I would do often, and you would read what these voices were saying, and it was actually kind of, it was kind of insulting, I'll just say that. These voices would say, because the person would be, so Cayce would be asleep on the couch, there'd be a stenographer writing down everything he was saying, because he wouldn't remember what he said when he would come out of the trance. And the questioner would occasionally ask, well, what about poems, what about my poems, and the voices would always say things like, you're not really doing anything, that's us. You know, we'll give you your poems as long as you're the vessel we want, but when we're tired of you, we're leaving. So, yeah, that's alarming. But the thing is, so I believe that I'm trusting these spirits, and I can only tell you that I have no idea why they're shaped the way they are. I enjoy it, I enjoy shaping them, and I do it, but I intuitively do it. I can't answer it any other way. Explanation for doing something I don't know what I'm doing, but I love it. You don't have to know what you're doing all the time to do it.
I have one more question, and then maybe I would have you, maybe we could turn the lights up already, just to be nice. I'm wondering about the Book of Frank.
Yeah, those lights.
Yeah, these lights, not our lights. We don't want to be, we want to see people more.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. When I read the Book of Frank, and now we've talked about it a little bit more, and so I think your answer will be, so this is kind of maybe a setup question, I'm not sure, but I know your serious investment in poetry, and that poetry is your life. And one thing that I was also noticing in the Book of Frank that just reminded me a little bit was maybe John Berryman's Dream Songs. Are those interesting to you at all? Or there's this sense of humor that's in both of them. I mean, Berryman's a very difficult poet to like, and that's why I was also like, there's no way he's actually going to like him.
I don't like the confessional poets because I'm just, you know, I liked them as a kid. You know, I was really into Anne Sexton and Sylvia Plath, but they all committed suicide. Like, that's no fucking road to follow, you know? They all failed poetry in their own way like that, you know? I'm not negating their careers, don't get me wrong. I mean, they wrote some important things, but I'm not interested in following people who, one after the other, just, you kill yourself, I'll kill myself, you kill yourself. It's like, fuck you, I don't need that. You know, I'm trying to stay alive, and I think poetry can do the opposite for us. It can heal us and want us to live. So I have no interest in John Berryman. I don't like him. And I especially hate that book, Dream Songs, which is why I have Frank kill him in the book. So the hearing you refer to.
Well, some things deserve to die, I guess, but yeah. Does anyone have a question? We'll take this one here and then that one there.
Hi, thank you for the generous performance.
Thank you.
Or present. I've thought a lot about when I read your works here, like how there's this aura to the poem, maybe also because of the form that Jean talked a little bit about, but and they seem, and there's all this ritual thing going on and the eco-poetics, which I feel is important, but then at the same time, they seem completely engageable or like open in some way and almost deadpan sometimes in the humor, very straightforward in their political points as well. And I'm just, how much do you, it's a weird question, maybe that's just a comment. I guess my question would be, is that a strategy? Or is it...
It's been a strategy.
Like the style as well. Like there, I think there's something important in that style, which is not just typical of the time right now, but specifically typical to you. So I would encourage you to talk about that.
I'm not being rude, but I really still am trying to figure out what the strategy is.
I think
no, not strategy, but I mean, I just feel that I was trying to pinpoint something I feel like is your style, which is what I feel, and that is what you do better than others. So just invite you to talk about that, like the spectrum between the deadpan humor and then the aura and the ritual and the straightforwardness in the political, I think.
Yeah, thank you. Let me see. Okay, so the question was it a strategy? I guess the answer is no. The strategy is to really see this world as best I can while I'm here. We're not here very long, and I feel like that's the strategy more than anything. Especially after the early 90s. I mean, when I arrived in Philadelphia as a teenager, all the gay men were dying. I mean, it was crazy. I went to so many funerals as a kid. I can't believe it when I look back on it. But it really shook me up, and I feel like I write for those people. I feel like I also write for all my relatives who were creative, excited kids making little pieces of art and then worked in the factory. And like my Aunt Darlene, you know, retired from the dental floss factory and drank herself to death 6 months later. You know, like these people were just ruined. So I feel like I owe it to them. I owed it to them to like pull out of depression and to get myself together and really go forward with this that I believe in. And that's my strategy, to figure out how to live fully as a poet and to never waver from that. And I think as much as 98% of poets wind up stopping. It's just, the world eats you alive. This world is designed to destroy us the way it's designed right now. These stupid jobs we're supposed to work. It's a ridiculous idea for a planet. I don't know who thought it up, but they really should be slapped. It's just ruinous, it's ruinous, it's evil. And I think the most important thing right now is doing everything you can to get everybody in touch with their own creativity. We need everybody being creative, because it's the creative people who are going to figure out how to get out of these situations that are coming at us with the ice melting, with the very clear economic disasters that are on the horizon. You know, there's so many things that are about to just roll over us and destroy many people. But I think the creative people are going to be the ones that are going to figure it out. And I feel like that's the strategy.
How's the answer? Great. Thank you. I think there was a question over here in the middle. Sam, you had a question, right? And then, thank you.
I was really interested to hear about this memorialization, the drag memorialization you mentioned.
The what?
The drag events memorializing the dead.
Oh, yes.
And becoming overwhelmed. And also queer as a kind of move against misogyny. And I think both of those episodes sound very much like what we're still struggling with today.
It's worse than ever.
And I'd like to hear some more about either of those.
I'll tell you about it. It's very upsetting. I think that on November 22nd, 2010, when President Obama signed the repeal for Don't Ask, Don't Tell, was the end. It was the end of radical queers, and it was the rise of white gay supremacy. That's what I think. We have this ridiculous organization in the United States called HRC, the Human Rights Campaign. You might be familiar with it. It's like a yellow equal sign on a blue background. I've always been suspicious of them from the very beginning, that they have a lot of magic money behind them, and I always assumed that they were a government-funded organization, and now we know for a fact that they are. They produce a list every January of the top companies for gay and lesbian and transgender Americans to be working. On that list are Lockheed Martin, the world's largest weapons manufacturer, Boeing, Monsanto. I mean, it's just staggering. I met Marsha P. Johnson, who started the Stonewall Riot in 1969. She, and you know, the thing that everybody wants to forget about is the Stonewall was a black gay bar. And there's this horrible movie that came out last year called Stonewall, where the whole focus was this cute, young, blonde, white boy. And I just wanted to burn a movie theater down with people not in it. And just incredible, you know, that erasure of history. And I also think of people like Gus Van Sant, who is probably one of the most misogynistic directors alive right now. His film Milk about Harvey Milk is I'm so upset. It's funny, I was having two big fights when that movie came out. The first fight was with gay men who were upset that the straight man was playing Harvey Milk and wins the Oscar. And I would say, shut up. Do you know a gay man actor who could actually do as good a job? No. There's this dirty rumor going around that all gay men are incredibly creative. It's ridiculous. Everybody's creative. I've been to a lot of gay and lesbian film festivals, and there's a lot of crap to watch. So I don't agree with that. That movie upsets me so much, though, on the other side, because he erased every single woman, except for the one that he couldn't. The woman who made him who he was. If it weren't for her, we wouldn't even know. I can't even remember her name right now. I always remember her name, but all of a sudden. Anybody who knows the real history of Harvey Milk in San Francisco knows that it was the lesbians doing the work. You couldn't get a gay man to go on a march unless they were shutting down a porn shop. The lesbians did everything. And if it weren't for the women's movement, there would have never been a gay and lesbian movement. And to have those giant scenes in San Francisco in the film with all those gay men marching really upsets me because there are no women. None. And that's what I'm talking about. And also I'm talking about, you know, I met Marsha P. Johnson. She was at a gay pride rally in New York City in 1990 in Tompkins Square Park with a sign that said Stonewall was a riot, not a trademark. And I was so excited to meet her. She was a very tall African-American trans woman. And hello.
Hi.
And what was I saying? Anyway, she was very upset by the commodification of everything that was happening back then. And of course, it's much worse now. I can't believe, you know, like I was invited to give a poem to this magazine, The Advocate, so this kind of famous, glossy, gay magazine, and I don't like this magazine. It's in the Eco Deviance book, and they said, we would like to publish this poem. They already had picked out this poem from a beautiful marsupial afternoon. It's the last poem in that book, and in that poem I discuss a homophobic neighbor who hears me having sex with my boyfriend, and they like that. They're like, yeah, you know, you're talking about the dominant culture and how homophobic they are. And I went back and I said, first of all, you don't deserve that poem. I want you to publish this poem. And the poem that I wanted them to publish was a poem where I say that gay and lesbian America has Stockholm syndrome, that we are now joining hands with a multi-trillion dollar military industrial complex, putting rainbow stickers on machine guns and killing Arabs with impunity. It's disgusting. Especially when you think about the people who started this revolution. Marsha P. Johnson marched in the street against the war in Vietnam. She marched for labor rights. She marched for women's rights. You know, to go from that to joining Lockheed Martin and Monsanto, I can't even believe it's happening. It's just unbelievable. I don't know what to do about it except nothing. I was on a couple of panel discussion groups leading up to the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I was the only queer person they could find who was willing to take the opposite side and say that we shouldn't repeal it because I don't believe in war. I would have young gay men, there are always like these young white gay men screaming at me from the audience, their faces turning red, they're so angry, saying things to me like, well, you don't care about working class gay and lesbians who want to use that the GI Bill to go to college. And I'd let them finish running their mouths. And then I would say, oh, really? Well, you don't care about poor people because nobody's asking the children of the rich to risk their lives and the lives of others for college. So if you want poor people to go to college, start a college fund. Don't ask them to kill people. This is the world we're living in now, and it's over. I think the thing in the United States is you're forbidden to admit defeat. Well, I always admit it now. We're finished. I don't have anything to do with the gay and lesbian community. I hate having to do all gay and lesbian readings. And I usually say a lot of things that annoy everybody anyway when I get finished. I have zero interest in following down that path anymore. I'm more interested in doing what we can all do collectively to change things for the better. And we have to.
And we've been trying to.
We're trying to.
I was going to ask you some like boring literary history type of question about the other thing that I thought of with Frank was like Ted Hughes, who is also a poet that I really dislike, and he has this crow poems. But
oh my god!
Yeah.
I mean,
it's not a comparison.
First Sylvia Plath. I mean, he drove her to suicide, and then his second wife to suicide.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm not that interested in Ted Hughes.
Yeah.
But
maybe the reason I was asking the question was like, or thinking about that was because like, I wonder like where poetry begins for you or something like that. Like, because you've talked a lot about a tradition of American poetry, which is very important to a lot of people, but you've also talked about the Bible, I guess, which is also in some sense.
Now, poetry began for me with Emily Dickinson.
Yeah.
So I'm 8 years old along the highway selling these flowers for my drug addict mother who can't get a job. And by the age of 9, I'm in the library looking for books to take out there to read, and I come across Emily Dickinson, and it changed everything. So starting then, that was kind of, so from 1975, I've been in love with poetry. And she was like my secret friend. You know, she was like this, some marvelous person that I would talk to. I wanted to read every single thing she ever wrote. I loved her. I also loved, I would have said at one time in my life, Walt Whitman is the same. He was very important to me growing up where I grew up, especially the Calamus poems of his, you know, those poems that are very open about homosexuality. And, you know, it's the kind of work you need to not kill yourself when you grow up in incredibly bigoted places, right? It's really hard to feel good about yourself when, you know, this is a thing right now, this is why I'm so involved politically right now in the United States against these laws, because I thought that it was ridiculous that this law had been passed about the bathroom law in North Carolina. But I went to that morning, I made the decision to cancel all my plans and go to the rally. And I met all these young people, these young queer kids who were devastated. And they were crying, and you know, I was just like, oh my god, I forgot what it's like to be that young and be so, you know, like, and it also sanctions violence against queer people, right? To have a lawmaker say that we don't deserve to go to the bathroom we want. So it just, so gay bashing is, of course, skyrocketing in the States, as you can imagine. And, but anyway, Walt Whitman was very important to me, and then I get to Philadelphia and find out that he was probably one of the most racist poets ever. I mean, it's just incredible. And I believe that he was trying to clean up the despicable human being he was with the poems. His prose is so alarming and upsetting that it makes me want to puke when I read it. He started reading Darwin, and he literally, I mean, I was hanging out with the poet Anselm Berrigan, who wanted me to consider the fact that maybe as he got older, he changed his view. And I said, well, I'll look into that. So the biographer Traubel, who lived with Whitman the last 3 years of his life, would write down a lot of things that he said, and it was just, I mean, alarming. He actually got worse. His racism just got worse. He literally write these articles where he would say that African Americans, he would not call them African Americans, by the way. He used the word nigger. He used it all the time. And when he started reading Darwin, he would say, the nigger in the engine will be exterminated because their gene pool is too weak, white people's gene. It was so, you know, and I wrote an essay about this. And let me tell you something. Walt Whitman is the most taught poet in the educational system in the United States. He's this great, great grandpa poet. Everybody wants to feel nice and cozy in his big, moist beard, right? Well, I would get hate mail like I've never received this kind of hate mail. People were just furious with me for saying this about Whitman. And the most common argument that I would get was, well, you, very dismissive, well, you don't understand the 19th century mindset of America. I said, oh, really? So let's follow your logic here. Your logic is that if the majority opinion is centered around this, then you must say, well, that's okay then. That it's okay to exterminate Native American people and then enslave Africans, kidnap them from their homes in Africa, and bring them here to do all of your work for you. I said, so just leap ahead a mere 50 years to early 20th century Germany. You know what I mean? Are you going to? And by the way, when the death camps were being built in Poland, there were still former slaves living in the United States. So it's not, the timeline doesn't work for me. Emily Dickinson was my go-to. And you know the poet Billy Collins, everybody thinks is so great. He wrote a rape poem about raping Emily Dickinson. And because all this research was coming out about whether Emily Dickinson was a lesbian or not, and he really gives it away. If you go online and look for the interview with Billy Collins with Terry Gross on NPR Fresh Air, you can listen to the MP3 file, and at one point, she's giggling in this bizarre way, and she's saying, oh, Billy, you're so funny. Tell us about this poem about Emily Dickinson. He said, well, I'll tell you, Terry. So all these people were saying, you know, maybe she's a lesbian or not. Well, I'm here to set the record straight. As he says this, right? So he actually admits on the air, and he'd been lying previously to this to cover up what it was, but he admits it on the air. Then he reads the poem, and he's basically raping Emily Dickinson to prove she's not a lesbian. Like, that's kind of crazy. And Emily Dickinson is amazing. And then I started hearing about her from teachers, and I was appalled. Because they started talking about Emily Dickinson as this, like, wilting lily hiding behind her curtains in Amherst writing her poems. And it's just ridiculous. This is a person who was very well read. She read every poem she could get her hands on. Centuries of poetry came to her doorstep, and she rejected it all to create something new. That's courageous. That's not a wilting lily. Emily Dickinson is amazing. Some of the other poets who have changed my life, oh my God, poets, some of them still, like Alice Notley. Audre Lorde was a big one. Audre Lorde just changed everything for me. Her prose and her poetry, she would give me strengths over and over again. Yeah, that's where it starts.
Will's got a question in the back.
I'm going to ask a question, and just kind of a common question about the loss of habitat, and Goethe's comment about the loss of habitat eventually consuming the human habitat, and how close are we to that, given those statistics? By the way, we need to look at, you know, and following up on that, Alden Nielsen's book on the modernist gives all the letters of Wallace Stevens, E. Cummings, Horace Pound, and Mr. Eliot. Just completely reactionary bunch. By the way, during that period, the NAACP would always raise a red flag in New York when there were lynchings, and the flag was practically always up. So this has been the situation that we have inherited. In fact, there's an article in Times today about all of this. You know, the dwindling of the human situation. Can you just comment on the animal habitat circumstance a little bit more?
Yeah, well, you saw the image that I put up earlier with the 52% loss of wildlife. That is from a biennial report that came out 2 years ago. Actually, this month we're due for the next one from World Wildlife Fund. It's the Planet Index, so it's the basic overall health of the planet. Coincidentally, the exact same time that came out, Alex Renton from The Guardian newspaper in London came out with an article that's since become like a pamphlet because it was such a popular article. It's called, let me get this correct, The High Cost of Cheap Meat. What he did was he crunched the numbers, he scoured the planet crunching the numbers for the animals incarcerated for their flesh, not the ones even for their eggs and their milk and their fur, but just the ones we incarcerate and imprison for their flesh. From samsara, from birth to slaughter, right? 60 billion is the number. Currently there are 60 billion animals alive on the planet for our consumption. He claims that in the last 4 or 5 years, the number of incarcerated animals has outnumbered the wild ones. That's where we're at. And it's just accelerating. And I don't know where to stop. There's a documentary, it's kind of a bad title, but it's one of the most important documentaries of our time. It's called Cowspiracy. But it's really, you must see this if you can see it. And it talks about how all of these so-called environmentalist groups like Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, how they're really just lying and covering up the truth about how the real problem is about animal consumption. And we could get into that if you want, but that's really the big thing. Like, it takes 16 pounds of plants to make 1 pound of flesh. So if you give up eating meat, you're just freeing up incredible amounts of plants for the world. And tens of thousands of gallons of fresh water to make your meat. And hundreds of thousands of watts of electricity, 2/3 of the electricity in the United States goes to animal production one way or another, from freezers to all kinds of things that are calculated into that, right? We really need to consume less meat. We need as many vegetarians as possible right now, though. It really is essential. And Greenpeace and all these groups, they're afraid of talking about this because everybody gets freaked out if you tell them to stop eating their favorite macaroni and cheese and meatballs their mother used to make them. Your food is your body. It's a very personal thing. People take it very critical. It's very critical, but the fact is we are already past the critical point. I don't know. I mean, there are so many. Okay, so here's an animal. I love this animal. It's still alive. You should see it go on the internet. It's called the o'o. It's a bird from Hawaii. Beautiful bird. And there's footage of this little bird with his beautiful plumes, and he's singing his song. He sings his song, and he tilts his little head, and he's listening for another bird to sing back to him. And he doesn't hear it, so he sings again. He's the last one. There are a lot of last ones right now. So it's just heartbreaking to see this little bird singing and singing and singing and singing and singing, and he's just gonna probably die of heartbreak. There are none left. And so yeah, that's where we're at. A lot, for instance, I spent the last fall, I spent 2 months, 2.5 months in at the Headland Center for the Arts in Marin County, California, right on the other side of the Golden Gate Bridge. And it's now wildlife rehab for injured seals and whatnot. So my first day, I'm out there walking on the beach, Rodeo Beach, and there are dead seagulls everywhere. There were 2 dozen dead seagulls scattered around the beach. I've never seen this in my life. And I saw this young woman with a clipboard, and she was going around writing down, and she had a Marine Mammal Rescue Center t-shirt on, and I said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "Well, I asked her, I said, well, why are all these birds dead? And she said, the ocean is warmer than it's ever been, and ever since they've been recording the temperature, and the fish are diving deeper to cooler temperatures, and there's nothing for them to eat, and they're starving to death. So then that afternoon, I went into Sausalito, which is just 5 minutes away. Sausalito has become one of these like super gentrified places for the super rich. So there's like a yacht club now. It has this rich literary history, but now it's just like a little shopping mall for rich people with their fancy wine bars and their Gucci stores and all that nonsense. And right in the middle of the street is a dead seagull, emaciated. And standing on the curb where all these people walking by with their bags of very expensive goodies is a scrawny, dying, starving seagull screaming at the dead one. And I thought, oh my God, this is our world. We're oblivious to the oblivion that we're bringing, you know?
There are also those, there's a video of the lyrebird in Australia where David Attenborough is like getting really close to it and like getting really excited in his David Attenborough voice. And then he's like, this bird can mimic the noises of all the forest. And he's like, but it can also mimic like human noises, and it mimics the shutter of a camera, and then a car alarm, and a chainsaw. I remember the first time I saw that, I was absolutely shocked. Like, so it's even beyond that, you know, like.
Well, that's the thing, right? When I talk about vibrational absence, the wild organic sound leaving, we're replacing it with our song, our sound. So when I was born in 1966, my body was formed on this vibration that was very organic and wild. And now children born in 2016 are born on a metallic sound, our machines, our bombs. And I'm very sad about it. And you know, I see all this addiction to video games, and I think it makes sense. Everybody is choosing the virtual world at this point. And there's like this exodus from the real world happening. And maybe they're right. I don't know.
Any other questions? No? Sia, would you read another?
Okay, I'll read one more poem.
One more poem. Thank you all for coming over the past 4 nights. It's been really wonderful, and this is our last poem of the series.
So I want to read a poem, the last poem to be from the new book. It's, I enjoyed doing this a lot. This was very enjoyable. I'm going to read the ritual, if you don't mind, and then the resulting poem, okay? Deja Vu Bus Ride for Eleanor Wilner. For over a decade, I would see her on the bus or in the vegetable shop near my apartment, always looking at everyone and everything, never on the phone or listening to music. One of those rare people who is truly present. I would see her see me, and when I smiled, she always returned my smile. We have observed people and things together for years, but never met, never talked, not once. We have never heard one another speak. In my journals, I refer to her as my deja vu friend, because seeing her destabilizes my reality the way deja vu will do. Then I closed down my apartment and left Philadelphia. While house-sitting for poet Eleanor Wilner after a year of being on the road, I went to my old neighborhood in search of my deja vu friend. I wish I could say there was a great search that lasted for days, but no. She was waiting for the number 21 bus, and it was the first time I was getting on with her deliberately. I took notes for the poem. I didn't want to break our pattern and introduce myself, So instead, I occupy the space as a fellow observer of the world. I took more notes for the poem while studying the many hair wraps, shirt collars, and a myriad of expressions, quite often in the same face. After a few blocks, our eyes met, as usual. But she not only smiled, she nodded. When I returned the nod, my smile was one of my favorites, because it was for my deja vu friend. She got off the bus at 36th Street, and I continued to write and observe to 45th Street. So this is the resulting poem. So basically, I take notes the whole time, but they're not documentary. They're very fast to get ahead of that editor, just trusting the ritual is going to help me figure it out. The title of the poem is, I Don't Know You, I Miss You. I put this book inside you, a gun in the next century. Tremble for our fragility, celebrating on our soft palate death. I flew over the city on the woken strata of my sleeping body. There is an elegant dance of broken spider webs on ceilings around the world. I want to see them all. I need to pause here to mention the blue butterfly coming through this poem, asserting herself into the poem, flying over my pen and hand, suddenly forgetting questions of how or why we live. Small creatures move through the forest no matter how many emails we send. Wild ones believe the slaughterhouse is more humane than the zoo. My poems might be softer on the body than your gun, but